Welcome to As a Woman, Fertility Hormones and Beyond. I'm your host, Dr. Natalie Crawford, and I am a board-certified OBGYN and fertility physician, and also co-founder of Fora Fertility in Austin, Texas. Each week on this podcast, I discuss health and fertility and how they relate to your true self. Become a part of the community of collaboration that amplifies others as a woman. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, and welcome back to the As a Woman podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Natalie Crawford, and today we are talking about uterine fibroids and the relationship and management options when it comes to fertility. And this is something that has changed over time. We have more options now, but it's very important to understand that fibroids are common and what you should or shouldn't consider doing about them if you're trying to get pregnant or you have infertility. Before we dive in, I just want to say thank you guys so much for all of your support here on the podcast. We love answering your questions, and so many of these episode topics come from questions that you ask. You can ask questions on Instagram at Natalie Crawford MD every Monday. Some of the questions will be answered there on Instagram, and some questions will be answered here on the podcast. You can also sign up for the newsletter at nataliecrawfordmd.com/newsletter, where we will give you updates, answer questions, and share hot takes on fertility in the news. And my very favorite option is for you to call the voicemail. You may have noticed some of the Q&A episodes, and those are your voicemail questions. You can call and leave a voicemail asking a question about anything, and we will put it in our queue to answer. The voicemail is 657-229-3672. Again, that is 657-229-3672. So diving into today, we are talking about uterine fibroid-related infertility, mechanisms, and management. This is a new paper being published in Fertility and Sterility. That is our favorite journal in the REI space because it dives into all of the topics that can relate to hormones and fertility. When we want to talk about fibroids, we have to start with, what is a fibroid? So a uterine fibroid, it's a tumor. And I know the word tumor can be very scary and very overwhelming. Just remember, a tumor is a ball of cells. And it is the same cell type, but in an abnormal growth pattern. So this is a tumor in the uterus. So it is the same cell pattern, cell type as the uterine tissue itself. And fibroids can be in different locations. So inside the uterus itself, you can have fibroids that are in the middle of the uterus, the cavity of the uterus where a pregnancy would implant, and those are called submucosal. You can have fibroids in the middle layer, the myometrium, the muscular layer. These are called intramural. You can have fibroids on the outer layer, and this is called subserosal. The serosa is the layer that covers the external surface of the uterus. And you can actually have pedunculated fibroids. So they have a tiny little stalk, and then they hang off the uterus completely, not impacting its uterine cavity or even the muscular structure or the architecture of the uterus at all. And as you can imagine, where the fibroid is makes a huge difference on if it has an impact in your fertility and your symptoms, and the size and location are two of the things that are very important here. Fibroids themselves are relatively common. They're the most common benign tumor of the reproductive system. We probably have an underreporting of their prevalence because if you don't have imaging done or have surgery, how are we going to know that you have it? But even knowing that, the current estimate of your lifetime risk over the age of 45 is 60%. So that's the majority of people. If you look at factors that make it higher risk to have a fibroid, Black race, family members with fibroids, not having any children, being overweight, PCOS, diabetes, high blood pressure. When it comes to the population that has infertility, we see them even more commonly, and this is because fibroids do tend to become present over time. If you just think about all tumors, if they're abnormal cell growth, that is increased in odds the longer those cells have been hanging around, dividing, etc. So the older you are, the higher the chances you're going to have a fibroid. And we are seeing people delay starting their family. Therefore, the people who are having infertility are also older. Is there an association with infertility or a causation with infertility? That has been a hot topic for the fertility space for a long time. And what I mean by that is it just you have a higher chance of having infertility as you get older. You have a higher chance of having a fibroid as you get older. So these two things are of association. Or is it you are older because you have infertility because of the fibroid? And the field has switched, meaning we really used to think fibroids were a major cause of infertility. And then some bigger studies came out showing that that relationship was less clear. And what I mean by that is the impact of uterine fibroids on natural fertility was unclear. And so if people had fibroids and were getting pregnant naturally, why were we cutting into people's uterus with fibroids for IVF all the time? When I first entered this space, the fertility space, as a physician about 10 years ago, we were definitely recommending surgical removal for anybody with a fibroid over 5 centimeters, even in context of if it didn't impact the uterine cavity, it was discussed. And now we're really not talking about removal at the current moment unless we have a fibroid inside the uterine cavity, so a submucosal fibroid, or it is in the intramural layer but protruding into the uterine cavity. Is that the right thing also? Huge question. And when do you intervene? Because is it really that that fibroid has no impact, right? It's a ball of cells, right? Where you're asking a placenta to try to grow into that myometrial later. These are really good questions that we have to be asking. Submucosal fibroids specifically, there have been 2 meta-analyses showing that they were detrimental to fertility, meaning pregnancy rates, ongoing pregnancy rates, live birth rates, lower with submucosal fibroids, so those inside the uterine cavity, than people without. And so this has been standard treatment that if you find a fibroid inside that inner uterine cavity and that submucosal layer, that should be removed. And the nice thing is that removal is really easy and low risk because it's a hysteroscopy, meaning I'm not cutting on your abdomen. There's no big surgical stay. This is a camera that goes through the cervix into the uterus, and we're able to remove the fibroid that way, so through a vaginal approach. And there's very quick recovery. Ultimately, that is a fast procedure, a day surgery procedure. So as a field and as a patient, if you have a fibroid and somebody says, oh, it's inside the uterine cavity and we should take it out, that's considered standard of care. I wouldn't fight on that one. Those are usually pretty symptomatic. So what are the symptoms of a fibroid? If we venture away from infertility, typically heavy bleeding. You can have cramping, so it can be painful. You have more myometrial tissue, essentially, so you have more pain, more bleeding. The bigger they get, you can have an increased uterus size. You might even look like you're pregnant, depending on how big it can get. You can have bulk symptoms, meaning the pressure from those heavy fibroids can really impact the space that you have in your pelvis and cause discomfort. The classic patient with fibroids is going to have an enlarged uterus, but regular periods that are heavy and painful. Irregular periods is not classic of a fibroid. With all of that said, fibroids inside the uterine cavity, those submucosal ones, because they disrupt the endometrial lining, absolutely can cause some spotting in between cycles or abnormal bleeding patterns, but you still have that regular period. You just have bleeding in between. The intramural fibroids, the ones that are inside the myometrial layer, the muscular layer of the uterus, those are the ones that the field has really shifted on what to do, and there's still a lot of debate. So where I was originally saying they all need to come out, now we have to say every fibroid's not the same, every person's not the same, and that's a very true statement. Different studies have shown different things. No impact on pregnancy rates. Impact on pregnancy rates. Only an impact if it impacts the cavity. So if it's far enough away from where a pregnancy implants, no big deal. Oh, it impacts pregnancy rates. It makes a difference based on its size, regardless of how close to the cavity it is or how many that there are. And now a thank you to one of our sponsors, Rocket Money. If you have been following, you know that I'm a fertility doctor, and at Fora, we just opened our own IVF lab. So I've been trying to save money because that's expensive. But it seemed like my bank account was absolutely stuck. So thankfully, I heard about Rocket Money and gave it a try. And it turns out I had a bunch of subscriptions that I was paying for that I have been too busy and I have forgotten about. Rocket Money helped me cancel some of them, and that is just making me feel so much better watching my account balance go up. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of 500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when they use the app's features. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/AAW. That's rocketmoney.com/AAW. rocketmoney.com/AAW. And now a word from one of our sponsors, Apostrophe. With the temperature starting to warm up, I'm so excited that summer is around the corner and getting ready and looking forward to the summer months. But I know that when I'm outside enjoying nature, I need to pick up supplies to prepare myself for summer adventures. And if you want to get your skin glowing in time for summer, it's time for you to get started with Apostrophe, who is sponsoring this episode. Apostrophe's goal is to help you feel confident in your own skin. So whether you're dealing with breakouts, signs of aging, or acne scarring, Apostrophe will help you love the skin you're in. I personally love that you get access to an expert dermatology team, a tailored treatment plan. It's simple to sign up for your first visit, and there is no in-person appointment or trip to the pharmacy needed. We have a special deal for our audience. Get your first visit for only $5 at apostrophe.com/AAW. When you use our code AAW, that's a savings of $15. This code is only available to our listeners. To get started, just go to apostrophe.com/AAW and click Get Started. Then use the code AAW at sign up and you'll get your first visit for only $5. Thank you, Apostrophe, for sponsoring this episode. So we can say that the field has relative consensus on if it's inside the cavity, submucosal, or if it's intramural in the myometrium, but protruding into the cavity, distorting it, that those need to be evaluated to be removed. The biggest debate is between the fibroids that are 100% intramural, but far from the cavity, or those that are close to the cavity. They contact the endometrium. A type 3 FIGO scale fibroid contacts the endometrium, but is 100% intramural, and a type 4 is intramural but not contacting the endometrium. And where we are most concerned are these type 3 fibroids. The entire fibroid is intramural, but it is contacting that cavity. And so studies looking at IVF cycles have tried to answer this question about, do type 3 fibroids need to be removed? To support this, a recent review showed that those type 3 fibroids decreased live birth rates, pregnancy rates, implantation rates compared to women who had zero fibroids. And the number and the size is what was correlated with IVF outcomes. Subsequently, FIGO type 3 fibroids that are 2 to 6 centimeters were associated with lower live birth rates, but those that were less than 2 centimeters were not associated with lower live birth rates. This is all low certainty evidence, meaning review studies, cohort studies, there has not been a randomized controlled trial looking at taking the fibroids out or not and controlling for all these other factors. Because having a fibroid versus not having a fibroid is not the same as going through surgery to remove the fibroid and seeing an improvement. Because if some of the reasons we think fibroids might impact pregnancy rates, is disrupted blood supply or impaired contractility, you're cutting the uterus and sewing it back together. And there's going to be inflammation and still an abnormality there. So the idea that fibroids versus nothing shows a difference is different than fibroids versus I took the fibroid out and now compared and it's improved. So we have to understand that something might be impactful, but that doesn't mean the treatment for that is clear cut or better. And so a big question remains, if we think the negative impact on your fertility is related to the size of the fibroid and how close it is to the uterine cavity, why do we not try to shrink the fibroid and see if it will move further away, which is called the migration effect? Why do people just rush to surgery versus trying medical approaches to shrink the fibroids? To answer this question, it's first really important to just go through the different ways, hypothesis, we think fibroids might have on fertility. So number one, I already mentioned this, distorting the uterine cavity. Again, we feel like this is clearly, if it distorts the cavity, an impact on pregnancy rates with IVF outcomes, largely because it's harder for something to implant if there's a fibroid in the way. Second is going to be endometrial and myometrial blood supply. So if there's this big fibroid, is that impacting the blood supply? Obviously, that blood flow is important for growth of the lining, but also that pregnancy, if we think about when that pregnancy comes in and gets really close to that lining and that placenta has to grow into that myometrial layer and connect the mom-baby blood supply, this could be really hard if there is something in the way. Another factor is an increase in uterine contractility. And if we think about this, what that means is that when a pregnancy comes to implant, and you've heard me talk about progesterone being so important, progesterone does a lot of things, but it also relaxes the smooth muscle of the uterus. And that allows decreased contractility when that pregnancy is trying to invade and grow into that uterine wall. If you have a lot of contractility, if that uterus is contracting, it's going to impair the process of that early implantation. And we've seen a study using MRI imaging showing that those intramural fibroids did cause abnormal uterine contractility, which could lower implantation rates. We've also seen abnormal factors that are associated with hormones and molecular changes that are important in implantation. The short answer is that there are some gene expression factors that are really important for implantation to take place, and you see changes of these in women with fibroids. And you also see a decreased release of some of the cytokines that are really important and help control that implantation process when women have fibroids. And then we have impaired endometrial receptivity. And there's a lot to say about receptivity. Obviously, we're still trying to study what allows the endometrium to be receptive and does not. When we have those submucosal fibroids, ones we've already decided are going to come out, we've seen studies showing that the growth factors and some of the genes, the mRNA expression of them, are different in women with submucosal fibroids than those without. But we're not sure that those intramural fibroids actually impact receptivity in this way if they're not in contact with that lining. So we have all these different proposed mechanisms. We have relative consensus on if fibroids are inside or distorting the cavity, what to do. But what about all the people out there who have those other fibroids? Should you be doing surgery? Should you be trying other things first? And then we have to think about there's also now other treatment modalities or procedural interventions that are not surgery. But I'm going to say this before we go into them. Yes, those of us in the field who've taken out fibroids, maybe we have a bias to lean towards that versus uterine artery embolization or MRI-focused ultrasound. But non-surgical fibroid intervention like that might be appealing, but the only strong evidence, if we're really trying to improve pregnancy rates and live birth rates, if you have a fibroid and infertility, is going to be surgical treatment. So a quick run through of the different procedure and the medical interventions, very quick. Hysteroscopic myomectomy. I mentioned this earlier because this is what we do for submucosal. this has changed. It's relatively easy. There are devices that make this very fast. Certainly, the larger it is, it has a higher risk potentially of complications. One of the biggest complications is that there is a blood supply with the fibroid and the uterus. And when we do hysteroscopy, we fill the uterus up with water. So some of that water can be absorbed into the bloodstream and can dilute your blood, essentially causing some fluid overload is the simplest way to think about it. You could also have uterine perforation or heavy bleeding. That being said, most people who do these are very experienced. We know what to look out for. And so those complications, even though they could happen, are ultimately more rare. Further, there might be a place for treatment, medical treatment, with medications like a GnRH agonist, which is Lupron, and we'll get into that, might reduce the fibroid size and make it easier to remove at surgery. And there's some very skilled surgeons who do even think that those type 3 fibroids, ones that are in the intramural layer, can be safely removed with a hysteroscopic approach and that you'll preserve more of the uterine cavity this way. If you look at the before after surgery, because remember we can't compare fibroids versus people with no fibroids, pregnancy rates after hysteroscopic removal of the fibroid really depends on the study, but it averages at 45%, which is typically an improvement. Now, a laparoscopic myomectomy or a robotic is a different approach. This is where you're going from the abdomen. You're using smaller instruments, so it's still a minimally invasive surgery, but what you're doing is cutting the uterus open from the outside to get to the fibroid. And the risk here is that later, because of this defect connecting essentially through the outside of the uterus, the part that really gets stretched when it comes to a pregnancy is uterine rupture. So that is a real concern, and the closure, the skill of the surgeon is going to be really important. But if you have a fibroid and this is the best approach, regardless of if it's laparoscopic or open, if you think about an open abdominal myomectomy, that's more of an incision like a C-section. So instead of using a camera and these tiny instruments, somebody is cutting you open more like a C-section to get to the fibroid. Both of those have a risk of the uterus rupturing later, and you have to let that uterus heal up after surgery. These type 3 fibroids, when removed by laparoscopic approach, had a post-surgical pregnancy rate of, on average, 49%. But the question is that these type 3 fibroids that we really think it's impacting embryo implantation, what's the best way to get there? I'm going to say that it is going to depend on the surgeon, the size, the number. There's not going to be a one size fits all. But what I will tell all of my patients is that you only have one uterus and it is so valuable. So we have to take those long-term consequences of scarring, rupture, distorting it more and causing more problems as real risks. And deciding the surgery to do is really important. And in transparency, I don't do these laparoscopic robotic abdominal myomectomies anymore because I don't operate enough at this stage of my career. So I have minimally invasive surgeons who are the ones doing it, and they are evaluating the location, the presence. I am making the decision. I think this needs to be removed based on what I am seeing, the size and the proximity, and then I'm letting the surgeon decide what's going to be the best route for removal. And now a word from one of our sponsors, Quince. The weather's getting warmer, so it's time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and hello to shorts and tees. I wanted to update my wardrobe for the long haul without spending a fortune. And luckily, I found Quince. Now I've got a lineup of timeless pieces that keep me looking effortlessly chic year after year. The best part is that Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands, but Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the cost of the middleman, passing the saving to us, and only working with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices. I personally cannot wait to wear my cute tan linen set this summer. So it's your turn to get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to quince.com/AAW for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/AAW to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/AAW. Thank you, Quince. And now a word from one of our sponsors, Ritual. Did you know that women were excluded from clinical research policy by federal law until 1993? But women belong in scientific research. They're essential, and Ritual knows this. I choose Ritual Multivitamin every day because it is easy to take, and I know that I am getting high quality and traceable ingredients in a clean and bioavailable forms. In fact, Ritual conducted a university-led human clinical trial for their Essential for Women 18 Plus multivitamin to assess its efficacy, and the results showed increase in vitamin D levels by 43% and omega-3 DHA levels by 41% in just 12 weeks. No more shady business. Ritual's Essential for Women 18 Plus is a multivitamin that you can actually trust. Get 25% off your first month at ritual.com/AAW. Start Ritual or add Essential for Women 18 Plus to your subscription today. That's ritual.com/AAW for 25% off. Thank you, Ritual. All right, uterine artery embolization is totally different. This is considered to be a uterine sparing technique from heavy bleeding. I have seen this save somebody's life after hemorrhaging from a C-section where you can't get the blood flow controlled. What happens here is that you are putting a catheter essentially through the groin vein and you're going up to the blood flow of the uterus, and then you're typically using a gel or a foam or a bead, some type of material to obliterate the blood vessels that are going to the fibroid. Most people will not recommend this to somebody who has infertility or wants to carry a pregnancy because of the risks on impacting the endometrial blood supply and function and impacting your ovarian reserve because of damage to the blood vessels. If you're decreasing the blood supply, we're very concerned about what that means. Yes, it can be extremely important for heavy bleeding or for saving your life if you're having a hemorrhage, but that's different than control of a fibroid in somebody who still wants to get pregnant. All right, newer techniques-ish that we are seeing being promoted is an MR or ultrasound-focused, essentially ablation of the fibroid. Only a fraction of patients will meet the criteria, and future fertility may absolutely be compromised. Even though there are studies promoting this, there are no data on pregnancy outcomes yet. Not recommended at this moment if you still want to have future fertility. And so back to if those are all the procedure surgical options, but your criteria to get to surgery depends on size and location, can we change size or location? What are your medical options? It's really important to understand that fibroids are hormonally sensitive because they're uterine tissue, but because they're abnormal cellular growth, they are all slightly different. And I have seen this, meaning some will grow in response to one hormone, others will shrink. So all of these treatments center around hormonal changes in order to try to change the growth pattern of the fibroid. So first is going to be birth control pills. Right, birth control pills are a synthetic estrogen and progestin, and even though they may help some of your symptoms, so it might be something you use to control the heavy bleeding or the pain, they don't decrease the fibroid size. Further, we do think that progesterone specifically is most likely to be one of the factors that is controlling the growth of the fibroids. Progesterone should not be used. It's probably adding, the study says, fuel to the fire, or this paper, meaning it's causing the growth to probably happen more. And so even if you're using a birth control pill and having both of them, it's really not an effective treatment. So birth control pills together or progesterone treatment alone, like norethindrone, not going to be recommended to try to shrink the fibroid size. That doesn't mean you can't take them if it's part of your fertility treatment. It doesn't mean there might not be utility to manage your symptoms, right? I'm talking about a very specific goal of trying to utilize medical treatments to shrink a fibroid, which is different than medical management. All right, what about Lupron? Oh my gosh, there's so much badness talked about Lupron, and I love Lupron. Lupron is a medication called a GnRH agonist. So if we remember, what happens is that in the brain, the hypothalamus sends out GnRH, which is gonadotropin-releasing hormone, to the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland sends out FSH and LH. FSH is follicle stimulating hormone that controls an egg to start to grow, which makes estrogen. Then LH controls the ovulation, the production of progesterone. An agonist is something that upregulates, but essentially what happens in a GnRH agonist like Lupron, you are seeing that the pituitary gland will release all the FSH and LH it has in its stores, but then it doesn't have any more. And so essentially then you have suppression from the pituitary gland where there's no more FSH and LH, and therefore ovaries are not ovulating, you're not making estrogen or progesterone. Lupron has been associated with increasing your hemoglobin, so being less anemic. It has been associated with decreasing the fibroid volume prior to surgery. So those are both good things. Importantly, it is not a long-term treatment, right? Women can't be with no estrogen or progesterone, especially in their reproductive years. It can cause decrease in your bone mineral density in addition to making you feel not good. So for more than three decades, long-standing medication we've used, GnRH agonists have been widely used to treat fibroids prior to surgery. And you've seen volume reduction and decrease in blood flow, so easier, faster surgical removal. There's a medication called a selective progesterone receptor modulator. So what this does is essentially block those progesterone receptors so progesterone can't have an impact in their growth. The advantage is that you don't have those low estrogen side effects, so you don't see some of the bone mineral density issues. Medications like this are UPA, which is olopristyl acetate. They have similarly shown a decrease in fibroid volume and improvement in anemia and improvement in risk of bleeding. So this has a potential huge benefit, but it's been shown that there's a rare but serious risk of liver injury. And so it's been denied approval in the United States. So it was effective, had less side effects, but it had one very serious but rare one. And so due to safety, this is currently not an option. All right. And then last thing here is going to be a medication called a GnRH antagonist. This is similar to Lupron, but the opposite, but essentially stops the release of GnRH. And this has also been shown that it might decrease heavy menstrual bleeding and that this could improve, obviously, anemia levels, and has also been shown to decrease fibroid volume as well. One of the issues with it is that they are more expensive and that these benefits aren't seen as much if you're given add-back therapy like estrogen and progesterone, which can help with some of the symptoms. So there is this in-between zone where some of these options may be beneficial, but we really don't have a great plan that this is the accepted approach, especially for these type 3 fibroids. So all of this isn't to say that there's no option, but I think understanding that as we're having new studies come out and people are evaluating this, the option for short-term medical treatment to try to shrink the fibroid and seeing the response to medical therapy, depending on age, fibroid size, might be beneficial to determine if you need surgery or prior to conception. If you are getting older, if you want to have kids, if you're going down this road, absolutely we have to have a strong consideration about getting embryos out first. And what that means is going through IVF, stimulating the ovaries, taking eggs out of the body, fertilizing them, and creating embryos. Then you walk the road of trying to get the fibroid or the uterus appropriate for conception. Because these hormonal treatments are going to shut off that ovarian hormonal production, and that's going to suppress your ovaries. Some of these surgical options might decrease your ovarian reserve. All surgery has risk. So what we want to do is not go through this time-sensitive process or delay that time-sensitive process till later if we think you need it, especially if you need fibroid surgery. If you're going to go have a laparoscopic removal of your fibroid, you're going to be told after surgery that your uterus needs to heal for at least 6 months before you can get pregnant. So we're having an increase in age-related issues. We're waiting. So the approach for a lot of times is going to be do IVF and get embryos, pause. Now you're going to go and focus on the uterus, whether that's Lupron treatment for a couple months and then re-imaging and see where the fibroid is and then consideration of surgery, whatever the current paradigm should be for you. And then once the uterus is ready, going and doing the embryo transfer. Delaying doing IVF or getting your eggs out in the search to get the uterus in this optimal zone can come back and hurt you. Fibroids or people who have fibroids are going to have a predisposition to them coming back, and they're hormonally sensitive. So just like we talk about endometriosis, what we see is that the treatment options prevent you from getting pregnant, and the act of trying to get pregnant stimulates disease. So we have to be very mindful and strategic in our approach so that you can have the family you want to have. Of course, it's really important to say that every person is unique and individual. If somebody tells you it doesn't, oh, this fibroid doesn't need to come out, it should be okay to say why, and they should have an answer, and it should make sense to you, and you should feel good with it. Not every fibroid needs to come out. Not every fibroid needs to stay in. So the impact of the stage 3 fibroid specifically and some of the stage 4 ones is going to be size, location, number of fibroids, goals. Are you undergoing treatment because your symptoms are so bad they're impacting your quality of life? Or is this primarily for fertility? I'll stress last that no treatment is benign, and I've seen people go through surgery and then have terribly scarred uteruses, or so little of their uterus left, or it's been so distorted that we don't feel comfortable ever putting an embryo in, or the lining won't grow. And the question is, would they have been better off not ever getting those fibroids removed? We don't know. So a stepwise approach, being very mindful about what we're trying to do, is always going to be the most important thing here. Fibroids are a hard topic because they are so common. One thing you heard me say over and over, no RCT, no study on this. That's because women's health has been so underfunded. Hopefully we will see specifically studies looking on treatment of fibroids and more specifically pregnancy outcomes on some of these factors in the future. But until then, this is a shared decision-making approach with your doctor. All right, I'm going to answer a few of your questions. This is our For Fertility Sake, our weekly Q&A segment. You can ask these questions on Instagram at Natalie Crawford MD every Monday. All right, these are questions that you submitted that we're going to answer. Why am I spotting while on estradiol for lining priming? So what I'm presuming this means is that we're in an embryo transfer cycle and we're taking estradiol, which is estrogen, in order to grow the lining. Why are we having spotting? So there can be a few different reasons. One could be the dose of the estrogen is not enough to grow the lining, so you still have some exposed blood vessels from your period. Number two, and what I'm immediately concerned about, is did you have the uterine cavity evaluated? Did you have a saline sonogram or a hysteroscopy? Did somebody make sure that the cavity is normal and that there's nothing like a submucosal fibroid or a polyp inside the cavity that could be causing some spotting? That would need to be answered for me to feel safe, like I want to keep going on, because if we had an abnormality inside the uterus, obviously that's going to impact implantation. And then last thing I'm just going to say is that you can have spotting, especially if it's post-coital spotting after sex. So that means post-coital after sex spotting. If you have cervical issues, so cervical dysplasia or precancer or cancer cells on your cervix. So if this spotting is specifically after you're having intercourse, then I'm concerned, do you have a recent pap smear? Is everything okay on your cervix? I have dark brown spotting for a week before my period. I've been off birth control for a year and just started trying to conceive. What could be going on? In this circumstance, there's a few different things that I'm concerned about and I'm thinking about. One could be that if you, especially if you took the birth control continuous, meaning you didn't have periods on it, which is a wonderful way to take birth control if you're using it for contraception, your lining might still be super thin. So when that progesterone comes in, the lining may not have gotten thick enough to last as long as possible. So one, how thick is the lining? Two, as I just said in the other one, are there any abnormalities inside the lining, inside the uterus, like a polyp or a fibroid? Three, what about ovulation issues that could be happening? Do we have high prolactin? Do we have thyroid abnormalities? This to me is concerning for a clinical luteal phase issue. So is our body not making enough progesterone? And remember, we view that as the first stage of an ovulation disorder. And you can listen to the episode before this on ovulation Q&A to hear more about that. But this warrants an evaluation, hormones and an ultrasound. So I would go see a doctor if this is persisting. Is there a benefit to taking the day off of work for my frozen embryo transfer? I feel like it might help me with stress. If you can take the day off of work, I always like removing barriers to success. Do embryos implant while you're up and living your life? Yep. Do we recommend bed rest? Nope. Does that mean you have to be doing your quote unquote normal? Absolutely not. This is a stressful day, an exciting day, but there can be some anxiety. And so making it special and going to get lunch or watching a movie or hanging out with your partner if you have one, that can decrease your stress burden because at this point, there's nothing else you can do. So if you have the availability to take off work, go for it. Do you have to? No. Physiologically, there's no reason why you can or can't go to work or be home. So don't feel like it has to be one way or the other. But if you can, it's my favorite day. I love to see patients who are low stress, who go play golf in the morning or go to yoga or who had brunch or they're doing something fun. Might as well take that day and try to make it more about you. All right, and last question is, what activity or exercise can I do the week after my frozen embryo transfer? So two things really important here is it depends on what type of transfer you had. In a controlled transfer, a medicated where we give estrogen, your ovaries are not stimulated. So some of the risks of activity come from the risk of ovarian torsion. So in patients who have a controlled cycle, you're able to do more things than if you have a modified natural or a stimulated cycle, essentially where you're getting medications to ovulate. Now, ovulating one egg, I don't restrict people, but if you're taking gonadotropins because you have a thin lining and I'm getting multiple follicles to make more estrogen, then I might tell you can't do running, jumping, twisting, inversions because I don't want those ovaries to twist on themselves. But in general, you can always still exercise, just you need to know what you can or cannot do. I don't recommend intercourse for my patients just because mostly the mental game. There's theoretical concerns about uterine contractility and implantation and being different on day of transfer versus later. But we'll just say in general, I recommend no intercourse until we've seen a baby heartbeat. And I usually say for activity and exercise, do your normal thing, although this is not the time for new activity, not the time to start training for a marathon. We want to keep your body moving, your blood flowing, but we don't want to be stressing your body out, trying to get new PRs, new gains, trying to cause lots of inflammation and muscle building and breakdown. So if you're somebody, and I have a lot of patients who are hardcore athletes, you can absolutely exercise, but we want you to be in a little bit of a different mindset of maintenance versus gains, if that makes sense. All right, well, I hope this helped answer some of your questions about uterine fibroids in general. It sucks sometimes when there's not a clear-cut answer, but I think it does help to understand the different options that are out there. Again, you can ask your questions on Mondays on Instagram at NatalieCrawfordMD, and you can call and leave a voicemail at 657-229-3672. Again, 657-229-3672. Thanks, friends. Thank you all for listening to As a Woman. It would mean so much if you could rate, review, and follow the podcast to be notified of new episodes every Sunday. I hope you learned something new, and I hope you share it with someone in your life. Be sure to follow along on Instagram at NatalieCrawfordMD and check out the YouTube channel NatalieCrawfordMD. If you're interested in becoming a patient, you can also follow Fora Fertility. I'm so thrilled to have you here, part of the community that amplifies others as a woman.
Hey guys, welcome to The Collective. I'm Brianne Helfrich, a 26-year-old bioethics PhD student and clothing brand CEO. Welcome to my podcast where we talk all things health and wellness, navigating your 20s, and becoming the best version of yourself. So sit down, play that episode, and join the collective.